The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Book of Serenity, Yunmen's Sumeru, the pointer. I always admire the novel devices of Yunmen. All his life he pulled out nails and wedges for people. Why did he sometimes open the door and set out a bowl of glue, or dig a pitfall in the middle of the road? Try to discern the main case. A student asked Master Yunmen, when not producing a single thought, is there any fault or not? Yunmen said, Mount Sumeru. Hongzhe's verse. Not producing a single thought, Mount Sumeru. Yunmen's gift of teaching is not stingy in intent. If you come with acceptance, he imparts with both hands. If you go on doubting, it's so high you can't get a hold. The blue ocean is wide. The white clouds are peaceful. Don't put so much as the tip of a hair in there. A phony cock crow can hardly fool me. I still won't agree to let you pass through the gate in the confusion. So this weekend we've been having an introductory retreat, which we're concluding this morning. And so the koan is a way of training in our lineage and goes back hundreds of years. So the Buddha said, upon his enlightenment, this dharma is subtle and difficult to understand. Cannot be understood with the senses, cannot be perceived with the senses. So what he said was that which will ultimately liberate us is in a sense dark to our senses. We can't reach it through our senses, which is how we come into contact with the world. And in Buddhism, the mind is one of the senses. So that means we can't know it with our conscious mind. The Buddha came to enlightenment through his meditation practice and a life and years of practice and asceticism and studying with teachers, and very importantly, his own discernment. And so in the schools of Buddhism that really put meditation as a central practice, what meditation is extremely important, because it is the primary vehicle by which we liberate our suffering, open our hearts, bring to fruition the Buddhist teachings, transform our lives, affect the lives of others. And so most of the traditions of Buddhism and the practices of meditation have this understanding that there is a calming aspect that is very important. Because if our minds are restless and agitated and distracted, then that's really what we've got. That basically takes up all the room. That's the show in town. And so that has to be addressed. That has to calm. That has to settle down, which our mind has the wonderful capacity to do. And so there's that element. But the tradition also understands that as powerful as that can be and as transformative as that can be, that transformation is impermanent because it's really based on that particular state of mind, which is calm. And that it doesn't uproot the views, the sort of the base of our bewilderment, of our confusion. Those can still be intact. We can have faith in those teachings. We can have faith in the clarity that sort of is the antidote to our bewilderment, but we're still fundamentally bewildered because the roots of it are still there. We may believe that there is no self, but the self is still present and active. And so the other element that is essential is referred to as insight. It's the aspect of our mind that has a bright clarity that is able to see into that which is dark to the senses. And so then the question becomes, well, what is the relationship between that aspect of the mind, the non-conceptual mind, and our conceptual mind, the mind that thinks? Because we're not just trying to eliminate thoughts, we're not trying to eliminate thoughts at all. We're trying to quiet the mind naturally, and that does take effort. It can't be passive. Because thoughts and our association with thoughts and our karma around thoughts is so entangling. But in a certain sense, we're also doing that, calming the mind, so that then we can employ thought. We can actually use thoughts in a way that is most powerful. And so this relation, and that is thoughts of the Dharma, the teachings, the we chant the Heart Sutra. Why do we do that? Because it is a fundamental teaching within our tradition of Buddhism, which is basically conveying to us, pointing us towards that truth, which when we realize is liberating. And so it's using words and language and meaning. So how do we, what is the relationship between chanting that sutra, which is important to understand those teachings, which means the words and the concepts. And for Westerners, for us, it means terms that have been Buddhist terms and concepts that have been translated in English. We really have to say, what does Buddhism mean when they use a word like wisdom or like compassion, right? Because it's not necessarily correct to just think of it in Western, our ordinary way. So we have to really understand, what does Buddhism mean by that? What does Buddhism mean when it talks about suffering, when it talks about the self or emptiness? And so there's this conceptual aspect of mind that we're, in a sense, we're trying to let go of. We're trying to release, get unentangled from that, and enter into that calm state, that natural state of serenity that the mind has a natural capacity for. Because then that more easily opens up the door to seeing directly into that which is beyond the senses. Because in that calming, it's not just thoughts that are calming, the senses are calming. They're not so active and agitated, right? And so our mind becomes much more spacious and more open. But insight arises, in a sense, based in our understanding of the Dharma. So in a sense, even though we're not holding a thought in our mind, we're being guided by our understanding of what Zazen is, of what, in a sense, we're trying to do, what we're aspiring towards. And so what is that relationship between the conceptual and the non-conceptual, in particular in our Zazen? And this is a question that has been around, I think, forever, and particularly in the Mahayana, perhaps, and that there's not, you know, there are different views. So some teachers might say that there's really, in a sense, no place for the conceptual, it's just direct pointing, direct insight, and you're really leaving all the conceptual behind. And other teachers will say, no, it's actually very important that those two aspects of the mind are working together, but in a way that is different than we know. And that's where the concentration, the samadhi that we're developing is so crucial. That's what allows the conceptual aspect of the mind to be alive in its most profound form, but not be discriminating and dividing and confusing and distancing. And so teachers will teach that differently. And my sense is that that's based in their own experience. Like, what did they experience? What was their own path like? What did they see that was most helpful? And how did they come to understanding, as well as what they were taught from their own teachers? And then, you know, what are they seeing is most helpful for their students? What do they need? And so the koan, coming back to the koan is a way, a particular way of bringing all of that in, right? Because it's using language, there's a situation, there's a dialogue here. It's preceded by a pointer, there's commentary afterward, there's a verse by Hong Zhe, who compiled this particular collection, there's commentary on that, there are footnotes, there's a lot of language in these koans that are ultimately trying to get us to go beyond language. A lot of words and meaning that are ultimately that are what they're pointing to is not in the meaning itself. And so it's a very interesting approach, you might say, which means that the practitioner has to approach the koan in a very particular way, not like before. And so it becomes, they bring it into their meditation and are learning how to hold the question in their mind in such a way that there is something there, but it's not, they're not thinking. They're not conceptualizing. They're not sitting in the meaning of the words, and yet the meaning of the words is there in the consciousness, but held in a way that it's not leading. Yunmen was famous for this because he was a 9th century Chan master. He was born on the eastern coast of China. He was born in a time of great political upheaval. You know, we might think of a lot of these great masters as sort of, you know, practicing in these quiet monasteries. Everything was wonderful and peaceful. They were just, you know, going about getting enlightened, having this great life, you know, enlightening the world, saving all sentient beings. And a lot of them lived in really, really tough times. And so he was born after, very soon after, a period of great distress for Buddhists, where Buddhists were basically being laicized. Buddhist monks and nuns, they were being forced to leave the robes, go back into lay life. Buddhism was being pushed down. He came at a time a little bit later than that, so he was able to enter the way, which he did at very early age. He studied with Master Muzhou, who actually had been a monk and took off his robes because he wanted to take care of his mother, who was ailing. So basically returned to lay life voluntarily. He was very fierce, and he had a house or a cabin or a hut where he lived, and people would come to study with him, and he usually kept his door shut. But if it was open, you could go in. And so Yunmen would go in and ask him questions, if he could get in. And one day he knocked on the door, and Muzhou said, "Who is it?" And Yunmen said, "It's me, Yunmen." And Muzhou opened the door, but blocked the door. He says, "Why do you keep coming here?" And Yunmen says, "I'm not clear about myself." And Muzhou said, "Completely useless." And there are two stories. One is that Yunmen just came to a realization. The other is that he started to close the door. Yunmen stuck his leg in the door. Muzhou slammed the door on his leg, broke it, and at that he came to realization. "I am not clear about myself." To know that is not a small thing. To know that can be the beginning of what may be one of the most important turnings in a person's life. To be able to know that and to acknowledge that and to not turn away from that and to want to turn towards that. A teacher commenting on this said, "What drives Yunmen is not some thing that bothers him, but rather his own self. This is not a problem that he has, but is something about who or what he is." We could say that Buddhist practice begins here. This is where the student enters. One day Yunmen asked another master, Kaoshan, and Yunmen says, "Why is it that one does not know of the existence of that which is most immediate? What is it that is most immediate, most important, most essential? And why is it that we don't know of its existence? We don't really know what it is. In ordinary life, we know what it looks like, what it sounds like. Do we like it or not? Do we want it or not? How much does it cost? How valuable is it? What's going to do for me? But what is its existence? What is the nature of its being?" And Kaoshan said, why don't we know the existence of that which is most immediate? Kaoshan said, "Just because it is most immediate. Because it is so immediate, we don't know." Another teacher said, "Because it is so very close, it is difficult to see." Right? If it was a mile away, we'd have no problem. If it was around the corner, if it was on top of the mountain, if it was on the shelf in a book, we would be there. We know all about how to go somewhere and find something. just because it is most immediate. And Yunmin says, and how can one become truly intimate with it? And Kaohsiung said, by not turning towards it. Yunmin says, but can one know the most immediate if one does not face it? And Kaohsiung said, it's then that one knows it best. And Yunmin said, exactly, exactly. Poynter says, I always admire the novel devices of Yunmin. Why did he sometimes open the door? You're on your way in the door and he puts out a pot of glue. Or why, as you're traveling down the road, does he sneak up ahead and dig a hole for you to fall in? And this is just a way of saying that one of the ways of teaching, Dada Roshi used to say, seeing the student in a cage, the teacher builds a cage around that. Why? We have to see the thing that is binding us. And usually that doesn't come so easily. We have to fall into the thing. If we want to really be free of anger, we do that from within anger. If we want to free ourselves of the clinging to the self, we do that from within the self. And sometimes to help us see that which is binding us, the teacher creates more bondage. Because the teacher cannot take the self away from the student. The teacher cannot disentangle the knot that the student has tied for themselves. They can't do that. But if they can help the student to see more immediately what they are in the midst of, what they are creating in their mind, that can rouse the student to do what only they can do. And so this is Yunmin's compassion, to help the student be clear about themselves. By not turning towards it, which can seem strange because there's so much emphasis on going towards the thing that we're afraid of, sitting with the thing. I was talking to, there was a teacher, Ajo McMullen, who came earlier this week, and Shoan spent some time with him. And after you left, we were talking, and I don't know, we got on to stuff. And we were talking about, you know, it's spring, hay fever, you know, nose drips. I said, what do you guys do with that? And he said, nothing. Let it drip. Oh, we were talking about how when I was in Korea recently, that I was told that, because I had hay fever over there, and I was blowing my nose, and they were, don't blow your nose in public. It's considered very rude. So if you're in a restaurant, you should go into the bathroom to blow your nose. You go outside. So I had to keep remembering that. So we were talking about that. And he was like, yeah, you just have to train, because otherwise you just, the Zazen becomes about managing. And it's just more managing. We just keep doing the same old thing, trying to correct, trying to fix, not trying not to be comfortable. From the outside, that looks ludicrous. It's like, wait a minute, I've got snot, you know, dripping down my nose all over my roxo. He said, just put a napkin over your roxo. What's the emphasis? What's important here? What is most immediate? Your mind? Calming? Not reacting? And in a way, snot's the simplest thing. It doesn't mean anything, right? It doesn't make you good or bad. It's not high or low. But it's just a simple, ordinary experience that we find uncomfortable. Can I train in this very ordinary, uncomfortable thing and not turn away? So first we have to learn to not turn away. I mean, why is our culture so brilliant at all of the ways of turning away? Endlessly. And to have fun doing it. And to feel good doing it. And to make a lot of money doing it. What are we turning away from? And so in practice, there's this sort of initiation of a revolution. Stop turning away. Stop. Right? But then ultimately, when we turn away, we're not turned away, we're turned towards something. It's still something. And so that too has to be finally liberated. And so Kaoshan says, by not turning towards it. This morning we chanted, it is not near, it is not far. We do not see it even as we're walking on it. And yet, if we're deluded, it seems to be mountains and rivers away. The Dharma is like, the path is like sitting down with a plate. And Dharma food, the thing we're going to eat, what do we put on that plate? Well, first you put your whole body and mind. And with that comes your history, your associations, your memories, your actions and their consequences, your successes and failures, your triumphs, your regrets, your pride, your envy. You place all the things that you are, all the things that other people have tried to make you be. Then you put the teachings of the Buddha, leave room for those. Then we have to bring in the 10,000 things, trees, clouds, bridges, rivers, tornadoes, computers. Place them on that plate in their perfect Dharma state, everything, every object. And then realize that on that plate is your mind. In fact, that plate is nothing but your mind. It's sitting on a plate, and that plate is as great as the ocean. It includes heaven and hell, birth and death, delusion and enlightenment. Now study it. Look closely. Now come a little closer. Now a little closer still. It's then that you know best, when you're no longer facing it, when it's no longer outside, no longer apart. Exactly, Human says. So the student says, when not producing a single thought, is there still any fault or not? The mind produces thoughts. Thoughts are made of words. Words turn into phrases. These have meaning. What I want to say to you, what I meant to say to you, what I want you to know, what I already know. You hear my words, you agree, you disagree. They sound sweet, they sound strange, soothing, harsh. They affirm what you already believe is true. They challenge what you think is true. They bring forth strong emotions. What happens next? What happens next? That's what's on the plate. That's what we study. And it's not so much on the plate, what's on the plate, but what's happening between you and that plate. What happens now? We're not producing a single thought. Is there any fault or not? So we practice to free ourselves of thought, not because thoughts are bad. We need them, we use them, they can have great power. And there is something that happens when the mind comes to stillness. There is a door, there is a window into our mind that is very difficult to see through when the mind is moving. At that moment, the student is saying, is there any fault? Every perception of fault arises through thoughts. There can be emotions, but we think about those emotions. And there are many ways in which those faults can arise. Expressions of clinging, of dukkha, of blame and anger, of fear and regret, holding grudges. They all arise with thoughts. That's how we identify them, we name them. We tell stories to ourselves about them. We build up cases about why. I remember on a train once coming back from New York, on Metro North, there were four guys who were friends, and they came in and they sat here, 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 and here. They all sat in separate seats. I guess if they sat together, somebody might think they were gay or something. I don't know. And then they proceeded to talk all together in loud voices. And one of them was talking about somebody who did something to him. And didn't he deserve to be angry? I deserve to be angry. Don't I deserve to be angry? Wouldn't you say I deserve to be angry? And I kept thinking, That's just another way of saying, don't I deserve to make myself suffer? Don't I deserve that? Am I not free to do that? Absolutely, you are free to do that. Do you believe yourself deserving of that? When the thinker has come to rest, when there's no thing in the mind, is there fault? No thought is not yet realization. The self can still very much be present. Delusion is not an error, it's not a sin, it's not a mistake. Although we can have many mistaken views. And through and within our delusion, we can create a lot of trouble. Delusion itself, in a sense, is not anyone's fault. Everybody has it. It comes through our senses, the way we see things outside of ourselves. So we can say it's not our fault, but what we do is our responsibility. When I am at fault, it's my actions, my intentions, my attachments, we could say are at fault. I am responsible. But they are not me. Your thoughts are not you. When we get so entangled in, when they have so much power over us, that's because we're identifying with them. They are me. Not producing thoughts is a natural state of mind, though it's not yet enlightenment. And if it were enlightenment, then people all over the world would already be enlightened, because there are lots of moments where we just don't have any thoughts. You know, you hear a loud sound and your mind stops. We'd all be enlightened in just that moment. The self is still present. So when not producing a single thought, is there any fault or not? And Yunmen says Mount Sumeru. Now Mount Sumeru is a part of Buddhist cosmology, that the whole universe is composed of Mount Sumeru in the center, which is great, enormous mountain. And it's surrounded by four worlds, and we're one of them. And in one of the worlds, the inhabitants have square blue-green faces. Life is pleasant, relaxed, bucolic. They are 48 feet tall. They live a very long time. And then in each world, they get a little smaller. Don't live quite as long. And then we come to our world, where it's traditionally 5 to 6. We may have to extend that a little. 5 to 7 feet, we got taller. We live 100 years if we're lucky. That's our world. So Mount Sumeru is the center. It's the great mountain. It's the primordial mountain. And so when not producing a single thought, is there any fault or not? Yunmen says Mount Sumeru. So the question is, what is he saying? What is this? Why is it that one does not know the existence of that which is most immediate? And so Yunmen says, Mount Sumeru. Kaoshan says, because it is most immediate. So the student working on this has to enter into, not the idea, not the history of, not the meaning of, but the mountain itself. And you could say, well, that's ridiculous. I'm a person. I'm a human. A mountain is a mountain. I am a person. We're different things. And my mind keeps telling me that over and over and over and over. This is what I am. And I know that every time that thought arises, and it gets stronger. And so in practice, you are letting go of that thought. Not identifying. The Buddha said, when you're sitting, don't think, I am sitting, I am letting go, I am aware. That's just continually reestablishing not only the idea of the self, but the thought that the idea that there needs to be a self to sit, to be aware, to let. There's just letting go. There's just awareness. There is no self. And so letting go of that idea that I am this and entering into the reality of Mount Sumeru in my mind. And the student knows they're doing this. It's a practice. And in order to enter into this great mountain, they have to let go of the idea that I am this. And in that, their experience, they're liberating themselves from the entrenched notion that that's who I am, that's all I am. And being that, I am not anything else. I can't be anything else because I am this. The student, in other words, makes it that which is most immediate. And so they start out by turning towards it. And then as they get closer and closer, which is just a matter of speech, because it is never anywhere else, there's a moment at which they stop turning towards it. There's just Mount Sumeru, nothing else. Now, is there a fault or not? And in that moment, the student has not become something. They have not become Mount Sumeru. They have not stopped becoming themselves. They have not produced something. They have not extinguished something. Those are also just matters of speech. Because to think of creating something means bringing something into existence. Why is it that the things that are most immediate, we don't know their existence? And so emptiness, to understand that things don't contain any intrinsic, inherent quality, substance, autonomy, existence, isn't nihilistic or nihilistic. Nagarjuna said, there is something in front of us. There is something sitting on our cushion. Buddhism doesn't deny that. But what is the nature of its existence? Because this seems most immediate. And yet, I can be so distant. Make it that which is most immediate. And when we stop turning towards it, then it can be known, but not as an idea. And so in a sense, we can know it without understanding. It's not conceptual. Or you could say we can understand it, but not know it. And so we sit in the posture of the Buddha, this mountain form, down beneath the earth, all the way to the heaven, with the stability of the mountain. But how can I be truly intimate with this? First, by not turning away. And then at the moment of ripeness, by not turning towards. When the sense of inside and outside, turning towards, turning away, being or not being, falls away. And that language is used over and over and over in the teachings. And it can sound kind of clinical or philosophical, but it's really pointing at the ground of being. It's pointing at what's happening all the time, in every moment, right here. And so our zazen, our mindfulness, our concentration, practicing letting go, cultivating compassion and loving kindness, practicing the precepts, liturgy, art and body practice, work practice, all of this is to know that which is most immediate. You know, what is with this seemingly, I don't know if it's universal, I don't know if everybody experiences this in every culture, but it seems pretty common, the sense that we go through our lives and we're doing stuff, we're touching things, we're having feelings, we're making decisions, and there can be a sense of distance, or even more, estrangement, alienation, isolation. And to note that the more isolated we become from ourselves, we become isolated from others, and that we actually, it's like a poison, right? It's like a poison. We actually get sick. Mentally, physically, psychologically, it's like a spiritual sickness that runs through the body. And when we don't understand, we tend to take it out on others. We find fault everywhere. And it seems that so many religious traditions have language for this, their own way of sort of saying that. Banished from the garden, separated from God, alienated from the earth, estranged from our Buddha nature. So there's this very common, it seems, experience of somehow being distant. What the Buddha realized is never has it been so. Never. There is nothing we can do to get closer. There is nothing you could do to get far away. And the experience of that distance, of isolation, the toxicity of that, the danger of that, the destruction of that. Because in essence, every form of aggression and violence and harm is based in some sense of separation that is being manifested. That can only happen when there is a clear and solid sense of self that has become isolated from something. And the fact that it actually makes us sick should, like, get our attention, right? In terms of what actually do we need to attend to? And there are many things that need attending that are all symptoms and symptomatic of that. But the root, what the Buddha realized, is within each of us. And so all of these practices to know that which is most immediate, to see through the veil. And so even to think of returning home, which oftentimes people say, it feels like I've come home. Coming here, for instance, or sitting in Zazen, there's a way of returning. And I know that feeling, and it's a wonderful feeling. It feels so warm, it's lovely, and it feels true, and it is, and it's not. Because you never left home. I can't actually do that even if I try. But the power of my mind is to create a felt sense that that is, and not only have I left home, but I am so far away. We can measure it in miles. We can measure it in years. We can measure it in unhappiness and all of my wrong decisions. And so that's, in a sense, the great challenge that started with the Buddha's own enlightenment. How do we turn towards that which we cannot, in a sense, turn towards? Right? How does water turn towards wetness? How does light turn towards illumination? How does the sky turn towards spaciousness? It doesn't, nor does it need to. If you come with acceptance, Yunmen imparts with both hands. We say, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. When the student is ready, the Dharma appears. Actually, when the student is ready, the world pretty much just shows up when we're ready. And being ready is not one moment, one thing. It's an ongoing state of growing up, coming in. But if we go on doubting, it's so high we can't get a hold. There is the self-doubt. Can I do this? Do I have the capacity that our culture loves to manufacture in us? And that's kind of its own toxic brew. And then there's just doubting samsara, doubting that if I just get a little bit more stuff, or if I hold on to it a little bit longer, or I find the perfect person, or the perfect job, or the perfect something. So doubting samsara is actually important. And with all the importance of accepting reality so we can practice it, not accepting samsara is pretty important too. Because we can accommodate ourselves to anything. And so to not accept that this is the only way that I can live, is what can initiate a path. Because all the while, as Hongzhi says, the blue ocean is wide, the white clouds are peaceful. Don't even put the tip of a hair in there. The faith mind says, the great way is perfect, like vast space. There's no excess, there's no lack. And that's pointing to the original nature of everything, like you and me. A phony cock crow can hardly fool me. And there's a story that goes around that I don't have time to go into, an ancient story. But basically, it's about being fooled, right? Being deceived by ourselves, by others, by the promise that if I just get the right thing, the right combination of things. And then the last line, I still won't agree to let you pass through the gate in confusion. And the footnote to that says, the order in India is strict. Saying these teachings are strict, it's hard. This path is long, it's hard. I don't think it's the path that's so hard. I think it's us. I think we're what's hard. Our minds create complications on complications upon complications. And so that's why Zazen is so brilliant. It allows us to both recognize and begin to disentangle, untie the knot, simplify, plain like water. And so for those of you who come for this weekend, I first, on behalf of the resident Sangha, thank you for coming and spending your weekend with us and throwing yourself in to everything that we engaged in all this weekend. I hope that it helps you, is helping you, will help you in some way, even if that's to clarify that your path may be in some other direction or in some other place. I think the important thing, I feel strongly that the important thing, and I think the Buddha, you know, there are instances where people would come to the Buddha and want to become his student, and he would see that they already had a path. And he would say, no, you need to just follow that, but really do that. And so what's most important is that if we follow a path, that it be true. And that's not a small thing. If we're going to devote ourselves, give our energy to something, it should be trustworthy. It should be worthy of our trust. And so to do our homework, be observant, but then to follow it, and that's the key. And make sure that that path includes everything. Because what would you leave out? And so know that you always have a seat here, ready, and that ultimately what you came looking for, you brought with you, and you will take home. Please never forget that. But translate those words into something more. I'll end with a poem. Spring surrounds us, drunk on the tides of life and death. Amidst the profusion of the miraculous, gentle breezes, so sweet, also carry the song of tears. They call out to the ones who can hear, who will hear, and who will answer with the rising moon of wisdom. Oh, troublemakers everywhere. May we all lay down our weary, pain-making arms. Having rushed past so many open doors, the time has come to enter the one true place that is never anywhere else. The primordial mountain is calling you in. May your lives go well.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.